The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you looking to hit your fitness goals? Let Beachbody On Demand help you get there. No need to go to a gym or schedule a class. Everything is right there on your personal device. They have programs for any fitness level, and the workouts range from cardio to weight training to yoga, low impact, and even dance. There are over 600 different workouts on the platform. Beachbody On Demand even provides comprehensive nutrition plans to help you meet your goals, because working out is just part of the equation. Access to information on meal prep, variety of recipes, and simple but proven eating plans. You need to give this service a try. Right now, listeners can get a free trial membership when you text FTN to 303030. You will get full access to this entire platform for free. All the workouts and nutrition information free. Just text FTN to 303030. Text FTN to 303030.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. A reluctant president avoids a government shutdown.
I will never sign another bill like this again.
John Bolton joins the White House as National Security Advisor.
Bolton is known for taking some hawkish positions.
And a deadly hostage siege in France.
The gunman first hijacked a car in Carcassonne, killing the driver and injuring the passenger.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Government shutdown averted, despite a threat to veto a $1.3 trillion bipartisan budget passed by Congress. The president signed it Friday afternoon.
There are a lot of things that I'm unhappy about in this bill. There are a lot of things that we shouldn't have had in this bill, but we were, in a sense, forced, if we want to build our military, we were forced to have. There are some things that we should have in the bill. But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
The bill includes billions of dollars for defense spending, but doesn't include as much money as the president had hoped for a southern border wall or a DACA solution. The president called for Congress to allow him line item veto power. Meanwhile, President Trump is also taking aim at China, trying to narrow its trade deficit with the U.S.
They're the toughest trade actions he's taken yet against China, which he says is stealing U.S. technological secrets.
It's out of control.
The tariffs he'll impose on Chinese imports could top $50 billion.
It's going to make us a much stronger, much richer nation.
The White House shrugs off concerns about retaliation, saying any countermeasures Beijing might take would only hurt China in the end. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, The White House.
Stocks dropped more than 700 points Thursday on news of the tariffs. CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger advises patience.
I think it is imperative that we understand that this is the opening shot across the bow. Even if we look back to those steel and aluminum tariffs, we now know that 70% of the countries that would have been impacted from the original announcement are likely now going to have an exemption from that tariff. So we don't know how this lands.
Another staff shakeup at the White House Thursday, this time at the National Security Council.
The president confirmed what had been speculated about for weeks, tweeting in part, "I am pleased to announce that effective April 9th, former United Nations Ambassador John Bolton will be my new National Security Advisor. I'm very thankful for the service of General H.R. McMaster, who has done an outstanding job and will always remain my friend." Bolton, who will be the third National Security Advisor to Mr. Trump, seemed somewhat surprised by the timing when asked about it on Fox News, where he's a frequent contributor.
I didn't really expect an announcement this afternoon.
Bolton is known for taking some hawkish positions. In 2015, he penned an op-ed in the New York Times titled, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran." And in February of this year, he wrote in the Wall Street Journal about the legal case for striking North Korea first. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer tweeted in part about his appointment. "Mr. Bolton's tendency to try to solve every geopolitical problem with the American military first is a troubling one. I hope he will temper his instinct to commit our armed forces to conflicts around the globe."
When he served as UN ambassador, he was actually not able to win confirmation during the Bush administration. He was a recess appointment. So that speaks to some of the controversy that he has stoked in the past.
The National Security Advisor is not a position that needs to be confirmed by the Senate. Hannah Doba, CBS News.
President Trump's lead lawyer in charge of the Russia probe, John Dowd, also resigned, replaced by former U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is speaking out after data on its users was harvested and sold for use in targeted political advertising. Zuckerberg told CNN Facebook will take steps to secure user data and be more transparent.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened.
In a rare television interview, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg acknowledged his company should have done more to protect its users' data.
If we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
In 2013, a researcher built a personality quiz app that collected psychological data from Facebook users and some of their friends. The information was then sold to a third party, Cambridge Analytica, and used in targeted political advertising.
You can't share data in a way that people don't know or don't consent to.
Zuckerberg said Wednesday that in 2015, journalists told Facebook that Cambridge Analytica had data from its users. Facebook asked the company to delete the data. Zuckerberg said Facebook believed Cambridge Analytica had, after it provided them with a formal certification. In a Facebook post earlier Wednesday, Zuckerberg outlined some of the changes the company vows to make. He said Facebook will investigate all apps that had access to large amounts of information prior to 2014 when they reduced data access. Facebook will ban any developer that does not agree to a thorough audit and take steps to help users understand which apps they've allowed to access their data.
We're going to review thousands of apps. This is going to be an intensive process. But this is important.
Correspondent Vladimir Dutier reporting. Overseas, a terrorism standoff in the south of France ended Friday after a man claiming to be part of ISIS took people hostage. CBS News correspondent Elaine Cobb has more from France.
Three people are confirmed dead. The gunman first hijacked a car in Carcassonne, killing the driver and injuring the passenger. He then drove past a group of riot police who were out jogging, shot at them, injuring one. Then he went to the nearby town of Trèbes, where he went into the local supermarket. Eyewitnesses say he fired randomly into people there. Two were killed, several more injured.
That's where police confronted and shot and killed the gunman. In Mexico, the U.S. confirms the deaths of four Americans. Reports say the family was found dead at a condo in Tulum. Police are investigating. Back home, police say a video confession from a man they say was behind six bombs in Austin doesn't offer much insight into why he did it before he blew himself up.
Police say Austin bombing suspect Mark Condit confessed in a 25-minute video shortly before he blew himself up, but they still don't have a motive for the attacks.
He does not at all mention anything about terrorism, nor does he mention anything about hate.
Police tracked down the 23-year-old unemployed college dropout to a hotel outside Austin early Wednesday. When SWAT teams closed in on him, he detonated a bomb inside his red SUV, killing himself.
On the video found on Condit's phone, he talks in detail about how he built each of the devices, which police believe are now all accounted for.
The break in the case came when investigators identified Condit from surveillance footage in a FedEx store, dropping off two explosive packages. The Condit family says they had no idea of their son's darkness.
The family's present focus is on dealing with their shock and loss and in cooperating with the police investigation.
Investigators are still trying to determine how Condit learned to make the bombs. Nikki Batiste, CBS News, Austin, Texas.
Still to come, we check in on Puerto Rico 6 months after Hurricane Maria. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A cyber attack Thursday brought some city services in Atlanta to a halt. Here's CBS's Anne-Marie Green.
The attack shut down many of the city's computer systems. It's unclear if any personal data has been compromised. The hacker issued a ransom demand that called for payment in Bitcoin. The systems affected include customers' ability to pay city bills and access to court-related information.
Sacramento activists took to the streets to protest the police killing of an unarmed black man last Sunday. 22-year-old Stephen Clark was standing in his grandparents' yard when he was shot 20 times. Police say they worried he had a gun. CBS's Steve Futterman reports protesters disrupted an NBA game between the Sacramento Kings and the Atlanta Hawks Thursday.
Outside the arena, protesters chanted, "Shut it down." And they pretty much did. The game did take place, but it didn't start on time.
This game delayed.
And with the protesters blocking the entrances, thousands of fans could not get inside. After the game, the owner of the Sacramento Kings expressed support for the protesters and called for unity.
We're going to work really hard to prevent this kind of a tragedy from happening again.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Parts of the Northeast recovering from a midweek storm.
People in New York City woke up to find about a foot of snow on top of their cars.
I don't like it. I want the warm weather.
It was the same scene across the Northeast after a powerful spring storm punished millions of people from Virginia to Maine.
It's quite a storm. Every once in a while we get one of these.
Heavy, wet snow brought down branches and power lines. About 85,000 customers began the day in the dark, most of them in New Jersey and New York. In Delaware, ice and whiteout conditions caused hundreds of cars to swerve off the roads. There were more than 160 crashes in New Jersey, and one person died in New York when a van tipped over.
Dangerous conditions. I saw 10 cars stuck on the side of the road just on my block.
At the airports, passengers are scrambling to rebook.
We've had like 6 flights that we've been trying to get on, but every single one's just gotten canceled so far.
It could take several days before all the airlines are back on track. As for the snow, one consolation of a spring storm, temperatures in the 40s will help it melt quicker. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
It's rain California's had to deal with.
The rain is wreaking havoc on roadways across the state. In downtown Los Angeles, 13 people were injured when 2 buses collided on a rain-slicked freeway. Farther north, fire crews rescued stranded motorists caught by fast-moving floodwaters.
Thank God nobody was hurt.
But the storm also supplied some much-needed powder in the Sierra Mountains. With more than 5 feet of snow in the last 24 hours, Mammoth Mountain employees tried to shovel out the lifts. The biggest cause for concern is still in Montecito, a town that's just starting to rebuild after January's deadly mudslide. Renee Grubb is riding out the storm in her house.
You know that there's something happening up there, and you just don't know what it is.
Video Villarreal, CBS News, Montecito, California.
Correspondent David Begno returned to Puerto Rico 6 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island.
Driving through Humacao, we saw Alyssa and her husband on the side of the road with buckets. They come here to this faucet to get water because they don't have it where they live, and they haven't had it for 6 months.
By the light of day, Humacao looks like paradise. But without power and water, it is a living hell.
You don't see anybody from the electrical company working here.
We met up with Yvette Diaz, who wrote to us on social media, where she is demanding that officials restore power to her and her neighbors.
I don't think that we should be protesting for something that we need and something we pay.
When we left Diaz, we met with Luis Orlando.
Look at my house. Come over.
He wanted us to know about the problem people on the island are having, getting insurance companies to pay them a fair amount or pay them at all.
The water was up to here.
Orlando lives in a $98,000 house, and an insurance adjuster estimated the damage to be half that cost. But his insurance company only offered him $8,000.
Feel like you got screwed?
Oh, absolutely.
There is good news. More than 90% of electrical customers have power. But about 103,000 people do not.
Colonel?
David, welcome back to Puerto Rico.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Colonel Jason Kirk is leading the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers here as it helps the Puerto Rico Power Authority restore electricity in places like Utuado.
My father asked, why aren't you burying the lines? We're not burying the lines because if we were doing that, we wouldn't have power back today to 92% of the populace because we'd be doing a new time-consuming design effort.
It took nearly 6 months just to rebuild the Utuado Bridge. That's in the central part of the island, which restored a lifeline to thousands of people who had been cut off for half a year. Volunteers are the unsung heroes of this story, rebuilding roofs, distributing solar panels, and handing out water filters, as Jamie Amos and his wife Lisa have done in Yabucoa.
Here in Puerto Rico, one of the things that's so beautiful is that people who have share, and it seems appropriate that if we are here and we are living here amongst the people, that we can share with what we have.
And to that point, there's more good news. Even though some people are still displaced, we didn't see any long lines at the gas stations or the banks anymore, and the grocery stores are stocked. But remember that about 100,000 people here in Puerto Rico are going to go to sleep without no electricity. And they've been doing it for 180 days. David Begno, CBS News, on the southeastern shore of the island in Humacao, Puerto Rico.
President Trump came under fire for congratulating Russian President Vladimir Putin on his re-election amid allegations of ballot stuffing and other fraud. The two did not discuss Russian election meddling. Correspondent Elizabeth Palmer reports from Moscow on Putin's landslide election victory.
It was a frigid night.
Успех! Да!
But the welcome couldn't have been warmer.
Россия!
Russian voters Россия! Cheered Vladimir Putin's return to the Kremlin.
Россия!
They'd cast ballots for him on Sunday because in part they admire his tough style. Remember that speech 3 weeks ago where he bragged about Russia's new nuclear weapons, featuring an animation showing one heading for Florida? Well, securely back in power, he seemed to pivot and offer a big Russian bear hug. We plan no arms race, he says. And then he announced cuts in military spending and a desire for international dialogue. Putin's made plenty of enemies with his meddling in America's election, his military intervention in Syria, and the alleged poisoning of an ex-Russian spy in Britain.
Scaling back Russia's provocative behavior abroad is a big shift for Vladimir Putin, but he may be forced to do it by the millions of Russian voters who now want him to concentrate on their problems at home, which include health, education, and most importantly, jobs. Elizabeth Palmer, CBS News, Moscow.
Up next, the event that one reporter says brought Stormy Daniels and President Trump together.
Among the companies there was Wicked Pictures, which is a porn studio, and Stormy Daniels was staffing this booth.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you like this podcast, check out what other podcasts are available from CBS News Radio.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times, okay?
Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez.
That's what this president has always been about. He divides people.
Samantha Bee, our very special guest.
I think I just realized my voice is really boring on podcasts. I'm sorry, everyone.
Not at all. Subscribe now for a new podcast every Friday morning. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Police say a lovesick scorned teenager opened fire Tuesday at a high school in southern Maryland before he was killed.
Shortly before the opening bell, the call went out for shots fired at Great Mills High School.
Had one CPR in progress. One with a gunshot wound to the head, one with a gunshot wound to the leg.
Police say 17-year-old Austin Wyatt Rollins opened fire in a hallway and shot 16-year-old Jalen Willie.
There is an indication that a prior relationship existed between the shooter and the female victim.
Blaine Gaskell, the school resource officer, a former SWAT team member, responded within a minute, firing one round. Investigators say Rollins fired his semi-automatic handgun at the same time. He was later pronounced dead, but it's not clear whether the officer shot him or if he shot himself. A 14-year-old boy was also wounded in the incident. How would you describe the actions of that SRO?
No question that his actions, his quick and immediate actions, potentially saved a great number of lives.
But the school district superintendent said what happened is not so unusual anymore.
If you don't think this can't happen at your school, you are sadly mistaken.
Investigators say they have videotape of the shooting, and it should help them figure out exactly what happened. Jeff Begay, CBS News, Great Mills, Maryland.
The girl shot in the attack died Friday after she was removed from life support. The family of one of the victims killed in a pedestrian bridge collapse in Miami has filed a wrongful death lawsuit amid concerns warning signs were ignored. Here's more from CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman.
We all were in shock, obviously, the whole family.
Joe Smith's niece, Alexa Duran, died in Thursday's bridge collapse. He's demanding an explanation into how this disaster could have happened.
I want to see some people be responsible. I want to see some people come up and step up and say, hey, the buck stops with me.
No one has done that. but there may have been warning signs of structural issues. Just 2 days before Thursday's horrific collapse, one of the lead engineers for the project left a voicemail with Florida's Department of Transportation.
Some cracking that's been observed on the north end of the span. From a safety perspective, we don't see that there's any issue there, so we're not concerned about it.
But that message wasn't heard until Friday, a day after the incident.
How did this happen? How could this happen?
Attorney Matt Morgan represents a client who was injured in the collapse.
I believe that once the cracks were identified, the first step which should have occurred is the lanes of travel should have been closed immediately until there was a solution and until those cracks were repaired.
Florida International University and its contractors say they will cooperate with the ongoing NTSB investigation. FIU President Mark Rosenberg.
We have a sense of urgency about getting to the bottom of this accident. Right now, our focus is on the victims' families and doing everything in our power to comfort and support them.
Mark Strassman, CBS News, Miami.
New concerns about the safety of driverless vehicles after an autonomous Uber SUV in Tempe, Arizona, struck and killed a woman.
Uber has been testing self-driving vehicles in Tempe for just over a year. Arizona's governor welcoming Uber's autonomous fleet after they were banned in California due to safety concerns.
I hope this brings new jobs. I hope it brings convenience and safety.
But just 1 month later, this Uber self-driving SUV was involved in a crash that sent it rolling onto its side. No one was injured, but the incident led the company to temporarily halt its testing. Now this latest deadly crash may once again raise questions about the safety of Uber's self-driving technology. The company tweeted a statement saying, "Our hearts go out to the victim's family," adding they are fully cooperating with local authorities in their investigation. Chris Martinez, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Now let's go back to the White House, at least to President Trump. On Sunday night, you can watch Anderson Cooper's 60 Minutes interview with porn star Stephanie Clifford, better known as Stormy Daniels. She claims she had an affair with President Trump years ago and was paid $130,000 in hush money by his lawyer before the election. She's now suing the president. Ben Schreckinger is a correspondent at GQ and is just out with a new story on how Stormy Daniels and now President Donald Trump first met. Ben, describe the setting and the circumstances.
Sure. It was a celebrity golf tournament held every year on the shores of Lake Tahoe. And at this golf tournament, there was a gift room where all the celebrity participants could go and be showered in free swag. And among the companies there was Wicked Pictures, which is a porn studio. And Stormy Daniels was staffing this booth. And that's how she and Donald Trump ended up in the same place at the same time.
In your story, you mentioned that Stormy was part of almost an emissary of porn stars. How unusual is this that these events include folks from these studios?
Talking to celebrity participants like Maury Povich, he said this was not a regular thing, that this was not happening every year. But at least in 2006, they were there.
What do you know about their encounter?
What I know and what we were able to get additional corroboration for in the course of reporting this is that not only did Trump and Daniels have an encounter this weekend, but they invited another porn star who wasn't even part of this delegation from Wicked Pictures. She just happened to be in Lake Tahoe that weekend and run into Stormy Daniels. She has come out in the past and said, they invited me to come party with them in Trump's hotel room that night. I declined. We were able to get in touch with her then boyfriend, now husband, who also confirmed that and confirmed that this woman called him while this was happening and said, "Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels are inviting me to Donald's hotel room. What should I do?" The boyfriend said, "Don't go." So this woman turned off her phone and went to bed.
Do you think at all this so far alleged relationship fit into any pattern for President Trump? Or does this tell us a little bit more about who Donald Trump is?
I think it does. There have been all sorts of allegations about Donald Trump and extramarital affairs going back decades. He seems to have started dating his second wife, Marla Maples, while he was dating his first. So him having affairs is not something new. But during this period, 2005, 2006, it's when he married his third wife, Melania. It's when his fifth child, Barron, was born. It seems that during this period, he was engaging in extramarital affairs, and also, according to allegations of several women, you know, unwanted sexual contact at a higher frequency than in other periods in his life. So it seems like he was going through something personally at this time where he was really acting out in his personal life.
GQ correspondent Ben Schreckinger on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, a new discovery into how we evolved.
It puts hundreds of thousands of years earlier some of the essence of what it means to be human today.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. The space station is welcoming a few new residents, two Americans and a Russian, launched in a Soyuz spacecraft Wednesday. More from CBS News correspondent Peter King in Orlando.
The new crew includes two Americans, Ricky Arnold and Drew Feustel, both space shuttle veterans who helped build the space station. Arnold is a former teacher, and he plans to complete a project started by another classroom veteran, Joe Acaba, who just returned from the space station. Arnold will be recording some of the lessons that Krista McAuliffe had planned to teach on the Challenger mission back in 1986. There will be a few updates, of course, since the space station didn't exist back then.
A new cache of fossils has been found in one of the largest subway construction projects in the country. Correspondent Carter Evans has more from Los Angeles.
We've got mammoths and mastodons from one end. We're finding horses over here. It's been really fun.
We first met paleontologist Dr. Ashley Ledger 40 feet underground, where she leads a group of archaeologists in one of the most unusual digs in the country.
And because these fossils are so old, we're the first humans to have ever seen them.
Ledger is still deep in the dig and excited to share her latest finds.
What have we got here?
Quite a smattering of Ice Age critters and then a little more. There's mammoth material over by you. So this is a metatarsal or a foot bone from a bison.
The discoveries paint a picture of what Los Angeles looked like tens of thousands of years ago.
I think all of the people who drive the busy streets of L.A. every day are just going to be shocked to know that all of these animals were roaming essentially the streets around here.
Yes, right under their feet. This treasure trove is coming out of an area where you don't usually get to dig a giant 80-foot deep pit.
First, they found bones of Colombian mammoths that roamed here in herds during the Ice Age. They uncovered this 3-foot section of tusk and a nearly complete skull, a rare find.
This is the bucket list you always want to find at some point in your career, and then it's one of the first things we found here.
One of the first, but certainly not the last. They just made another unusual discovery, a bone from a giant sloth.
You think sloth, you think slow-moving, small, cuddly.
Small, yeah.
These are huge. They're taller than I am.
Wow.
She showed us a full skeleton at the La Brea Tar Pits Museum right next to the subway line.
It looks so vicious.
They do. They look ominous. They have these big claws. They're enormous. They just look a little too scary to mess with.
When we first met Ledger last summer, she was expecting to see a dramatic increase in fossils as construction approached the tar pits. That's because the prehistoric black ooze that still seeps from the ground was a sticky death trap for the massive mammals that once roamed here.
So we're going to be sticky and dirty, and we're going to love every second of it.
But for months, nothing materialized. Then suddenly, new discoveries exploded as the digging moved into Beverly Hills.
How frequently are you getting fossils?
Fast enough that I can't keep up. They're bringing me fossils almost every day.
It's a bonanza of bones. So many, in fact, Ledger hasn't been able to identify them all.
Probably a scapula or a pelvis from something of decent size, but I don't even know what it is yet. So this is behind the scenes. This is where the magic happens and where the researchers come.
Inside the museum's collection room, Ledger has a new bounty of bones to catalog.
One piece of a mammoth's toe is as big as your hand. I can take a field trip, spend an afternoon in the collection, and try to figure out what it looks like, what it matches up to, and at the end of the day say, aha, it's this animal, see?
Another unique find, an arm bone from an ancient sea otter, and the discoveries just keep getting bigger.
These are very heavy, very dense, but it's pieces of whale rib.
About 25 feet below the shops of Beverly Hills, mammoths and bison roamed tens of thousands of years ago. But 80 feet down, hundreds of thousands of years earlier, L.A. was underwater.
Animals like whales were swimming in the ocean that was in that exact same area.
This was the ocean.
Yes, it's mind-blowing to think about, but really exciting.
Subway construction will continue for several more years, building the future, while Ledger's team works to preserve L.A.'s prehistoric past. Carter Evans, Los Angeles.
Smithsonian scientists have discovered new evidence of human evolution that pushes back our evolutionary timeline. Dr. Richard Potts is the director of the Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History here in Washington. What did your team find?
Well, we're digging in the Rift Valley of East Africa, and in a site in southern Kenya, we discovered what we see as the oldest known evidence of innovation in technology. Of course, this is still simple stone technology, but nonetheless, a time of the beginning of innovation and of behaviors that are really interesting that are right linked to the time period of the origin of our species.
What kind of technology?
Well, we're looking at a transition from about, and these are big numbers of time, but from a half a million years ago to 320,000 years ago, quite a long time ago, that we see the transition from a large, cumbersome technology, what are called hand axes, to a technology that is smaller and more portable, one that was very carefully flaked, including the ability to knock off with one blow of a hammer stone these small triangular points that look like they are projectile points, projectile weapons, and that's the first evidence we have of that.
And what did these early humans use that for?
It looks like they were using it for scraping hides and for chisels to penetrate. We think they were digging out pigments, coloring material, and also, of course, the sharp stone points as projectiles would have been effective for hunting and perhaps for defense of the population.
So what's the big deal? Why is this significant?
Well, we're really dealing with the origin of our species and the kind of behaviors that characterize all human beings today. And we see right at the outset of our lineage, the beginning of technological innovation, the ability to be aware of groups at a distance and perhaps to assist one another through the transfer not only of stone, but also probably in back then food and water and things of times of scarce resources. And also we're seeing the beginning of complex symbolism through coloring material. Think of the ways in which we use color for clothing and uniforms, flags. And so those are the sorts of things that look like they are part and parcel of the beginning of humanity as we know it.
And how does this affect our timeline of evolution?
Well, we thought for many years that the modern human behavior, the behaviors that are familiar to us today may have been quite a late development, maybe something about 50,000 years ago with the beginning of cave paintings that we see in Europe and other parts of the world. But this is considerably before that, not 50,000 years ago, but 320,000 years ago, and it puts hundreds of thousands of years earlier some of the essence of what it means to be human today.
Dr. Richard Potts of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, a new evidence of human evolution. Thanks, Dr. Potts.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Coming up, the Parkland students in their own words on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. More details have emerged about the American victims of a helicopter crash near Australia's Great Barrier Reef. More from reporter Scott Meeman in Brisbane.
It was a trip of a lifetime for 79-year-old Pete Hensel and his 65-year-old wife Sue, both from Hawaii. They were married in December last year. This was their honeymoon. They'd spent several weeks in Australia already prior to this week's helicopter crash. Those who survived the crash were Sue's 33-year-old daughter and her 44-year-old husband. Both are from Colorado.
Cirque du Soleil is mourning the death of performer Yann Arnaud, who fell to his death during a high-flying, choreographed routine in a live show in Tampa.
Aerialist Yann Arnaud and his partner had completed a series of choreographed flips and spins before Arnaud's hand appeared to slip from the strap, causing him to plummet to the stage below. Taylor Avery was at Saturday's show.
He looked like he hit his neck or his shoulder and laid there motionless, and the paramedics took him to the hospital.
Tampa police say he fell 20 feet to the ground. Arnaud had been with Cirque du Soleil for more than a decade, most recently part of its touring show, Volta, a production centered on extreme sports. Cirque CEO Daniel Lamar says they use safety nets and harnesses when they feel they're appropriate, but didn't feel they needed them here.
We have been doing straps in a lot of our shows for many, many years. So far, we never had a major incident, and therefore, over the years, nobody thought that we needed to have either a safety net or an harness.
This is the second deadly fall during a live Cirque du Soleil performance. In 2013, 31-year-old Sarah Guillard-Guillot fell about 50 feet during a dramatic fight scene in the Las Vegas show, Ka. CEO Lamar says he will review the results of an independent investigation to see if changes need to be made for future shows. But for now, he says he's focused on honoring Arnaud's legacy.
He was a total demonstration of what Cirque is all about, meaning trying to impress the public, traveling around the world, enjoying himself by doing the one thing he loved to do in life.
The CEO says Arnaud's wife also worked for the show, and his Instagram appears to show two children. The final two performances in Tampa were canceled. Tony DeCoppel, CBS News, New York.
This weekend on 48 Hours, Aaron Moriarty is back, this time with a story of who killed a 31-year-old mother of three. Aaron, what happened?
Well, that's a really interesting question. What makes this case so significant, and it's the reason why I chose it, is because what happened might not have happened 20, 25 years ago without high-tech evidence that came in this case. I have never been to a trial where high-tech evidence was maybe even more important than human eyewitness testimony. A Fitbit played a part. A Progressive Insurance GPS tracker on a car played a part. The Google dashboard on an Android phone played a part. And what was so interesting about this is that the technology didn't just incriminate somebody, but it appeared to exonerate the most likely suspect. So it's just a really fascinating case. A woman disappears. She is found within hours in a field. She has been beaten and strangled, and it's a terrible crime. They look at her boyfriend. The two have been fighting the night before. They see what looks like blood in the garage. They find blood across the street. It looks like they had a fight outside. He kills her. He transports her to the field. That's what they thought. He doesn't seem like he's that worried. He waits till the afternoon to report her missing, but he's wearing a Fitbit. And the police notice it in the interview, and they look, they download that information, and it shows he only walked about 12 steps all night. He was sleeping. So, you know, how could he have killed her? How could he have transported her? These are all the questions. Then the DNA comes back, and it's not blood in the car. It's not blood in the garage. So they have to let him go. But thank God there's this amazing, very sensitive DNA test that didn't exist 20 years ago, YSTR, that is showing that there is an unidentified male DNA. They keep searching for a full profile. They put it in CODIS. Voila, they have someone. And they have his phone, which that's the Google dashboard, the most incredible location information. But at trial, he says, well, yeah, I was with her. But the boyfriend did it. So then again, these devices that we take for granted, that we exercise with, became crucial at trial to provide an alibi.
The future on 48 Hours. You can catch Aaron's Report on 48 Hours on Saturday nights on CBS Television or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Correspondent Aaron Moriarty. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Steve.
This weekend, CBS News airs a one-hour documentary on the Parkland, Florida school shooting. It comes as students take part in the March for Our Lives rally here in Washington. The broadcast embedded CBS journalists with a group of students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School who banded together to fight back since the attack. Here's a clip of that broadcast.
Well, I checked Nick's pulse. I couldn't reach Helena. She was farther away, but Nick was right next to me. So I checked his pulse, and so did Sam. And then I saw Nick and Helena were dead.
I called my mom, and it's like the same time Dylan called the police, and she could hear the gunshot, she could hear the fire alarm, people screaming.
Your mom?
Yeah, and like I told her, I checked their pulses, I was holding Helena's hand, and I told her it was going to be, my mom could hear all these things, and I told her to hang up.
Within seconds, we were all cowering in the corners of the classroom and looking through that front door and saw the barrel of the gun coming through and just shooting, trying to aim at students in the classroom.
911, what is the emergency?
Hello, where are you?
Stoneman Douglas High School.
Please. What's going on?
Who? Is he shooting at us, please? Please, I'm begging you, please.
Please. I have help on the way, ma'am.
Stay on the phone with me, ma'am. I'm getting a school shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland.
Please hurry.
You can also watch 39 Days on CBS All Access. Finally this weekend, something a little lighter, the wild popularity of a parody of the Second Family's Bunny Book.
Mike Pence's daughter says even she has bought the John Oliver book that parodies her own book.
At the end of our hop, I said, Wesley, I don't want to hop without you ever again.
The Comedian's Tale portrays the Pence family bunny as gay, a poke at the vice president's opposition to things like gay marriage and military service. Charlotte Pence's bunny book for kids is being outsold by Oliver's. She says she bought a copy because proceeds go to charity, and she's all for that. Steve Kath and CBS News.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.